All right, why don't we get this meeting of the Newbury Port Conservation Commission going? I would announce to the audience that we are recording this, but there's no audience to announce it to. So, first time on the agenda is the minutes from January 3rd, 2012. Do you have any comments?
Just a couple of little ones. Under Crow Lane landfill, about halfway down, that paragraph where it says Andy and Julia will visit the site, and she will visit the site. And down a little further, where it says I moved to request a report, it was moved to issue an enforcement order of issue request. Under Ultraclad, the last part of it, negative tree determination, the conditions, etc. And you have, and the pad is elevated 6 inches. It was, I think it was the containment walls were elevated 6 inches above the bridge. And under Whitty Air.
The pad and the erosion, and the.
Right, oh, yes. Under Whitty Air. Close to the end of that first page, where any reports of the contingencies would be handled through special conditions, and it should be said the contingencies could be handled through special conditions.
Under Whittier Bridge, I was just going to suggest, I don't know if this is proper format, but I was going to suggest that when we change a topic, I think there were two little like paragraph breaks we could put in there. Lots of talk about, looks like about 10 or 12 lines about the light, the shade study. And then a monitoring mitigation plan would be paragraph break number one, I guess. And then another break about the riprap being installed. Joe Chizera asked if riprap was installed. And then I think a third break where the planning plan topic begins. And that was my only comment.
But getting back to the enforcement order, that's substantive. I mean, did an enforcement order issue? On the landfill.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, but actually, to update you, just before 4 o'clock, 3:58 today, I got an email from Jabal, who's their attorney, saying that they wouldn't be able to make it tonight, or he wouldn't be able to make it tonight. He was expected to be here. He said that they responded to the erosion concern. We went out there to see some of that work. I had been out there to follow up, because when we were out there, they were still doing the work. But they were picking up some vehicles and stuff. But, he said that somebody would be able to be here tonight on the simple benches. So, maybe if you let it off, we'll just check again and see where they left off. But they were putting the handrails up on the upper slope. Somebody may have been out there since then, putting some handrails up on the upper slope, but they hadn't put it down. The second place we asked them to put it was on there's an access drive on the side of the landfill. So, put some on the outside of that so that, well, they can still be able to do the inspection of the landfill. There wouldn't be anything in the second area, basically capturing things before we're done to that out of the area and then in the water. But I don't know if they've followed up on that because they're not there since we
Did you and Julia get to go up there and did you mention you were going to go look at the back side?
We did look at the back side. There wasn't anything immediately that was more of an issue, but there were a couple of areas. We did mention a couple of areas that we particularly take a look at because they had the potential, it looked like those they had the potential for maybe. We suggest that they go out there. I haven't seen that area since then.
Mm-hmm. I'll go back out tomorrow and take a look at it.
If it's warm.
Okay. Anything else in the minutes? Motion.
Move to approve with the changes.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay. The wetlands ordinance. We have a... they will not be discussing it tomorrow night at the planning and development subcommittee meeting. The only change to the committee is Tom Jones is out and Katie Ives is in. And we're just going to discuss those zoning changes tomorrow night. So Barry said that they would be probably discussing at the next committee meeting. So
it would be announced.
To be announced.
Katie was the other sponsor of the ordinance along with Barry,
yes.
So that's good for the planning and development committee. But we've had a difficult time trying to pin down the next planning and development meeting where we're by Barry difficult to time that. My hope is that the planning meeting and development meeting tomorrow will finish with the zoning thing so that we can then get them focus on the ordinance and all the things. We'll take up both at the same time.
Yeah. It'll be a fun meeting tomorrow night, I'm sure. Then, number three is a discussion of the agenda format. Julie wanted to do that.
We put that on the agenda because, just because I wasn't aware that it had changed, and in talking with Andy about it, he said it was that way when he got here, and we just had some questions about why the separation of the order of conditions from the handling of the actual hearing. And the concern is really based on the fact that the applicant is no longer there when you're discussing conditions and in the circumstance that maybe you can't come up with conditions or if members can't agree on conditions that would be appropriate for the project, then the applicant isn't going to be aware of the fact that the permit might not get issued at that point. So.
Yeah, that
well, there are a couple of reasons, as I recall, as to why we went with this. We were looking for a process that would be more expeditious because these things tended to drag on.
Yeah.
And, you know, we'd be sitting here hemming and hawing over conditions with the applicant and the project team sitting there, which, you know, never seemed very professional. Part of it, though, was back in 2008, 2009, as we were approaching this, we were much busier than we are with NOIs, and we were running into some really long meetings. The other thing that I wanted to say was that when Mary Riley was conservation administrator back there, she often had a lot of input on the special conditions, which caused that process to take longer than has been the case in the last 10 months or so. So, I mean, I think there were a number of reasons, but for me, a main reason was that I was enthusiastic about it was that I was looking for something that would make it move more efficiently than it was moving.
Yeah, and I think that's a worthwhile effort for sure. I would have agreed with that.
I mean, as far as the applicant not having input, I mean, you know, once the public hearing closes,
they can't have input.
You can't get into a dialogue with the applicant over the conditions.
Part of our concern was less about, I mean, we agree that the efficiency side, I thought that would help, definitely. But and I initially, you know, felt concerned when I saw the commission's agenda format being very different than other boards, not only here, but also in other municipalities that work. I really haven't seen any instances where the board or commission would, after the public hearing is closed, after it's decided that, you know, just to close it out, to later on during the evening discuss those things. And sometimes there's been a suggestion to the applicant, for instance, even the member of the public there, that, you know, that's not the deal later. I just feel a couple of the presenting the situation or presenting the idea that somehow it might be an executive session and somehow the commission has to have a discussion separately. And I just think it's better that, similar to other boards, that, you know,
different is that a number of boards, including the Beverly board that she was on, did it just this way. They separated the issuance of the condition. Now, I mean,
town of Redmond's team.
Now, I don't want to get into it, because I don't know. I don't want to get into how many boards do it one way, how many boards do it another way. Your experience is your experience, and that's great.
Right.
But, you know, as far as I'm concerned, this has worked pretty well for the last couple of years since we've been doing it.
Is there a meeting?
So I would need somebody to be pretty persuasive to cause me to want to change it.
Yeah, I personally haven't heard any complaints. And after every closing of the hearing, I try to tell people, we're going to do this at the end, and you're welcome to be here. And most people just leave.
Do you always do it at the end of the meeting, or do you sometimes wait till the next week? I was reading through the...
No, we do it at the end of the meeting.
I mean, I think that's an opportunity if things...
Right.
If we're waiting for more information or
right.
there's something that we're not sure of, but we want to deliberate
on
it.
So if you close the public hearing, even if it's a big project like this, let's say tonight the public hearing closes, then you may have one or two more hearings. You wait till the end of the meeting, and when the order of conditions section comes along, that's when you would hash through all the conditions for this project.
Yeah, I mean, that's been our experience since
there were a couple of times where they, you know, were complex projects.
Yeah.
And we, at the end of that meeting, when we closed the hearing,
okay, right after
we started to discuss, you know, the conditions at the end of that meeting, but we realized that we four times.
Okay. Well, would there ever be a situation? I guess I was just having a hard time understanding how it actually works in the case where you're voting to close a public hearing. Are you also voting to issue an order of conditions, and then you're just delaying the actual negotiation of the conditions? Or are you voting to close the public hearing, and then later when you do the conditions, voting on the order of conditions?
Yes, that. Yeah, that's
what we haven't even discussed it.
Right, so you can't.
Until we get into the discussion.
Would there ever be a case where you close the public hearing, and then at the end of the meeting, go to the order of conditions piece, and don't vote to approve it? I guess that's what I was trying to look at.
We have gotten into discussions of conditions, and we needed more information, or we wanted...
No, we just needed more time.
But
you
then
know,
if the applicant's there, and they think that they're going to... Or not there,
right.
Then you have to notify them that you actually didn't issue an order of conditions last night, and...
I guess I don't remember ones where we felt we needed more time. I mean...
Yeah, if we needed more information...
Very rare.
Okay,
yeah,
you need more information.
You need more public hearing, so you shouldn't be close to public hearing. There's a chance you need more information.
Right.
No, it wasn't a matter of needing more information. It was just that we needed the conditions were...
Needed to be worked out.
The wording was
going
to be difficult.
Yeah.
Okay, so it was the wording of the conditions.
Right.
It wasn't that we needed more time to... Well, maybe it was, I guess. I mean, if we needed to think about the wording of the conditions.
Right. Yeah, sometimes Mary would...
Like, if you knew you could condition it, and you knew basically what you wanted to have in there, but you just needed some additional detail in those conditions, then you might hold it over, and then she could send something.
Yeah, I guess that's right. It was. We'd go back and forth with suggested language.
Yeah.
People would be making suggestions, but we hadn't really kind of ironed it out into...
The best place to word it so they would get what we really meant.
And so your idea is that if you tried to do all that every time while the applicant was still there, you could take all night and other hearings might get held up for too long. Is that
Or maybe it was late in the day and we just needed some breathing space on it. I don't, you know, it's hard to
I found that having that interruption between the hearing itself and talking about the special conditions was very helpful to my thought process. You know how you step back, take a rest, and go back into it.
Yep.
But if we ever denied a permit, the applicant was pretty sure that that's what was going to happen later on.
Gotcha. And they might say we want a continuation.
So we gave them an alternate suggestion and said, you know, this is not an RDA situation. You're going to have to come back with a full permit.
But as Joe says, I don't think we've had a situation where anybody said, you know, this process was unfair. You know, I wasn't given an opportunity.
Yeah, I've never heard any complaints about that.
I didn't know what was going to happen with the conditions.
And the people who want to stay, we tell them we're gonna go over the order of conditions after. Mm-hmm. They're free to stay. We're not going to throw them out.
Because you were being on it, we expressed these concerns that we hope well in advance of anybody from the public expressing concern about it. It's not usual from my perspective, but from the community's perspective, it's not actually commonly done. It's probably not a good idea. I think that we've talked previously about recommendations that need to have the CCs made about, for instance, the ordinance. I have made some suggestions to modify the ordinance because I didn't feel like it would pass muster with our council. For the same reason, I don't think that just because another community is doing it doesn't necessarily mean it's a good idea. If the ultimate goal is to speed up the process and help things move along, by effectively, whether or not Frank is saying it, giving opportunity for other folks to sort of move on and not necessarily be here, that, you know, it seems to imply that there might be a meeting going on or a discussion going on where it might be better for them not to be here. And I don't think that's a good, whether directly or indirectly, situation he's setting up. I think that if there's more time needed for conditions, I think that we should deal with it right after the hearing and then continue from that point for some reason. But not be expecting more information from the applicant because we're already closed the hearing. Nobody can provide more information at that point. It has to be before the commission. And I would think the best approach would be that we do is with the planning board, for instance, or even the CDAs. We give recommendations or where we think the conditions might be. If there's any kind of special conditions, give a recommendation as to what we think those might be, rather than waiting until after the hearing to do that later on during the evening. There shouldn't be, at least from the agent's point of view, there shouldn't be anything that's really a surprise condition that might pop up that can't be written, you know, during that discussion.
No, we're generally discussing all the conditions during the discussion with the applicant. We're not going to pop.
There are no surprises.
There's really, I don't know of any real surprises that have happened in the order conditions.
The fact that nobody's objected or complained or pushed back for 2.5 years suggests that that's exactly the way it's going to
be. And I think, some of the, for the homeowner type applications where, a representative will come in to present the plans, I think they're very pleased with it because, they present the plans, we ask the questions, and they have a very, good feeling, and we have a good feeling whether it's going to be approved or not. So after their presentation, they can just leave. They don't have to wait around for another hour in case New Ventures is in.
Mm-hmm. Right, but also, if we have a bunch of NOIs sitting here, we have 3 or 4 NOIs. Everybody's who's concerned about the last one or the third one has to sit through the entire process.
Right, but they were all the other conditions. They also have to wait to the end of the meeting. Right now, we don't have a whole lot of application going on, so it seems to make sense that we provide those people with the same information before they leave, rather than making them wait through the other discussions to hear what their conditions might be.
But the public doesn't have to sit and wait. Maybe the applicants are going to have to sit and wait, but it's their project. Why should the public who wants to put input in have to wait 3 or 4 hours to go slog through 3 other orders of conditions to wait for their project? It's a much smaller time frame that they have to be here.
Well, one concern I have then is just to make sure that if this is the way it's going to go, that an applicant really gets to hear, especially if it's a small homeowner who doesn't know a lot about this whole permitting process, and they're going to get their order of conditions in the mail, and they're going to give it to their contractor. And the contractor may or may not really pay that close attention to it either. So to make sure that they understand what special conditions we're putting on the
but
project.
But they're not going to get that at the end of the day anyway. I mean, the order of conditions is 6 pages long, general and special conditions. And they leave at night.
They're not going to get that there. But if they're here to hear, I just want to make sure that they're hearing before they leave. Let's say they do just go home and say, you guys are going to do the OOC later. That if they're just going to go home and then sometime in 21 days get this thing in the mail, that they have heard what those special conditions are going
to
be.
And they have, too, in the discussion, because that's what the discussion is usually all about.
Right.
Again, it's not confirmation necessarily. The conditions that I've seen, even prior to approval, prior to my work at the commission, you're basically, you're both like conditions are
It has in the past, Andy, and that's why we changed it. It was really holding us up. This format is much more efficient.
Was that just with our last commission agent? I mean, I've not seen that situation
that was,
before.
Well, a year and a half ago, we started with this new format. How long ago did we start with this format?
It was 2009.
Yeah, whatever.
So you noticed an immediate
difference? Oh, yeah. It was way better. And we have, no one's complained about it.
Yeah.
We haven't gotten any pushback at all doing that.
We're just forewarning, I mean, you can continue with this process. It's a new choice. We're just forewarning that the name of it is an issue. We're trying to prevent the issue.
It hasn't yet.
In 2.5 years,
we used to have a lot more analogs than tonight. You know, it's a lot more bummed up.
And we're not cutting anybody off. We're just telling them that we're going to do this at the end of the meeting, and you're free to stay and listen to us. They're not going to have any input to it, to the process anyways. So they're free to. They should have enough interest to hang around for an hour to listen to their order of conditions if they're that concerned.
And sometimes they do. I mean, Tom Hughes tends to do that sometimes,
yeah.
Because
he's doing due diligence.
Well, and he's getting paid.
There's never a surprise topic that comes up with a special condition. It's already been spoken about in a public hearing. So there's never,
there's no curveballs.
A new special condition.
Right. If that was my suggestion, is there aren't anything, there isn't anything to do, you can just close it out right then and let them know what the conditions are so they're not sitting around waiting.
Well, you could argue it both ways, Andy, but the fact of the matter is it got a lot more efficient when we changed to this format.
I'm not convinced that didn't necessarily have to do with the procedures that were going on and recommendations coming from staff in the office. I'm not sure that that's an efficient process. It may seem like it from your point of view, but we deal with the applicants every day, come to the counter, we see the procedures and the questions they have about it. They may not be coming to the commission sitting here during the meeting because of their concerns, but we're trying to speed up the process and make sure that it makes sense for them as well.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not necessarily, that's not necessarily helping them and the process they go through. If the conditions are effectively the same as you've discussed, I don't necessarily see the reason for waiting to get the meeting to do something you've already just discussed a moment ago. And you could just easily put into a motion to approve or disapprove so that someone has that.
Did you give them their order of conditions, no cover letter? There's no cover letter, right?
No, the instructions go with it.
Is the cover letter, is it a boilerplate letter?
It's boilerplate.
Yeah. All right. I'm just wondering if you know, it would help put bullets in the letter. I'm sorry, I know I'm asking for more.
No, I don't think that's a problem at all. It's just, it's not about them clarifying the special conditions that are in there. It's mm-hmm. just that they're aware when they leave, and everybody else is aware when they leave this meeting, you know, what the conditions were, as opposed to giving the perception, even from the public's point of view, that there's two separate types of meeting going on, one that they're actually, you know, here for, the other part that's really not really under the business, sort of perceived as an executive session. I think if you're making it very clear to every person who's before the commission that that's what's happening, both mm-hmm. the applicant and the public, I think that will help the situation. I still don't think it's a good idea, but I think that will solve the legal concern that I'm concerned about. If we're not making that clear, folks, then I'd be concerned if we're giving the impression that somehow there's an executive session happening
right.
going on, but that's not actually the case. That's
well,
my primary concern.
So the legal, you know the hoops you got to jump through to do an executive session, and that door never closes.
Right, but the public doesn't necessarily know
it's
that.
It's a perception.
No.
Yeah, I just want to make sure there's not any difficult perceptions from the public that would cause problems with the commission. I bring this up because I want to make sure that we're not having these issues. And of course, our job is to bring these things up before they become an issue so that it doesn't happen. It's not going mm-hmm. to, you know, challenge the way the commission's been doing things, but just to point out things that might be improved to prevent issues down the road. Especially if you approach it and you're getting to like the board and just try to make sure that there's less issues that can come up.
I do have to say, from remembering way back when I was on the commission, that it does run so much more smoothly now than it did then.
Mm-hmm.
And that may be because of the format change. I think we just need to, like Andy's saying, just be really aware of that the applicant knows what's going to happen later, that they know that these are special things that are going in their permit. If we can make sure that they hear all those before they leave, then that's going to, you know, help out a lot. But I do see that things are a little bit...
Yeah, although the problem is saying that, you know, the first part of the hearing that they will learn about all special conditions isn't necessarily a good thing to let them think. Because what if, you know, we're just... the whole light of it, we may add other special conditions.
Well, that,
you know,
that would just worry me that we would be adding conditions that an applicant may or may not be able to comply with.
Right, exactly.
That they would have no idea that that would be
exactly.
What we're going to ask them
yeah,
to
yeah,
do.
That, that's really my only concern with it when we went to this format.
Right, but that hasn't happened?
No,
and they have to be told that, you know, it's going to be talked about at this meeting after the hearing is closed. And, yeah, be very clear about that. As
well. Yeah, well, make sure I'm very clear about it. I thought I was being clear, tell them we're going to discuss them after, but...
I just really wanted to, for me, I wanted to understand why the changes was made and how it was working and the sort of like the goals behind doing it this way. And I think I understand, but we just need to be careful about all those issues.
Okay. One other thing, I did, I had a meeting with the folks at CleanTech. On what's the name of the road?
Mulligan. Yeah.
Never mind. I drive it every day.
Yeah.
I know the name of the road. They were specifically talking about wanting to put up solar panels on their property, which is probably one of the worst properties in the whole industrial park to be putting panels on, because they're basically totally surrounded by wetlands. But they were more broadly, they were looking for a sense of the commission regarding they want to push to get a lot of the other companies out there to do solar panels too. So they wanted to get an idea of what we would be requiring. And you know, I gave them a heads up that we're doing an ordinance which may have some effect on some of that. But in general, I had a pretty good discussion with them, and they may or may not be putting them up on the roof. I don't know, but there's you know plenty of other areas out there that are wide open and not directly abutting wetlands that won't be an issue. But you know, I told them about the shading issue if you don't want to.
You know, just looking at this more globally from a environmental standpoint, would it be smarter to try to promote the idea of a solar farm that would provide power to multiple users?
I think they're
panels on their
property? I think they're thinking about that too. And one of the issues they were talking about, like with certain roofs, some owners don't care if you penetrate the roof. Some owners really care if you penetrate the roof, and that makes a big difference on how they're. How they put the panels up there, whether it's there's a what they call a ballast, basically a weight, concrete weight to hold the panels down, or whether you're connecting them to the actual structure of the building.
I mean, I do know one of the things we've heard over the years is, well, the roof won't support it, and I can't afford a new roof, and so gotta do something else. That's mm-hmm. kind of a common litany out there.
Mm-hmm. And there were discussions regarding green roofs, too. And apparently there's some guy who's going to be have an office at Green Tech has come up with some really light material that can be used for green roofs. It can be used for green walls. That apparently absorbs a lot of water and still weighs a lot less than
soap. Solar panels, really?
No, for just regular
yeah.
green roofs.
Okay. Because if they would need to do structural upgrades to do solar panels, they're definitely going to need structural upgrades to do a green roof.
Oh, yeah. Need significant structural upgrades for a green roof. Yeah. But there are other pluses, like insulation mm-hmm. and not worrying about mm-hmm. all sorts of wet snow on your roof either.
So is there a kind of a dialogue going between the commission, you, and this crew in terms of
well they were I guess they wanted to get a sense
an ongoing thing
I think so and you know they would like to I think the number he put out, he was hoping they could get the industrial park up to about 20% alternative energy and get it higher if they can. Whether I think they were mainly looking at solar, there was really no discussion with me on wind.
No more wind turbines.
They're looking for ways to sort of incentivize companies to stay in the industrial park.
Mm-hmm.
Companies that it's becoming less and less attractive because of the hoops they have to go through to expand or whatever. But if they can be actually achieving some revenue through things like solar or whatever, then that's just another incentive for them to stay here. And I think part of ClinTech's goal is to just encourage that kind of development within the industrial park, green developments.
Did you mention them the visit of the conversation you had about San Malcolm Way, one of the editions that they were at?
San Malcolm Way.
San Malcolm Way. Because we had both had conversations with them about the solar panels they wanted to run on their property, and we said to them, this is a visit I had with them months and months back, and I said, you know, it looks to me like you want to put them basically in the well, and they said, you know, it's probably not the best solution. I said, you know, given your site constraints, you only have a different area. We thought about the roof, and they said, well, the owner just recently did some improvements to the roof, not necessarily structural, but you know, ceiling or something. So I said, they didn't really want to do that. I said, okay. But keep in mind that you're having an impact on wells. That's going to be a notice of intent for replication areas, at least, you know, if the commission approves it. They didn't come back in months and months, and they finally had to do it, and they basically listed the exact same thing. You know, this is a notice of intent, at least. And I got the sense that either they didn't like the answer they got, you know. Or they didn't quite understand it, but we basically said, look, you know, it can definitely be done. I personally do not have any problem having, you know, waiver type provisions or expedition, you know, type of expeditious procedures for that. But I think that it's still a notice of intent, and that they're still having an impact on wells and probably some applications. So, you know, hopefully they understand that there's some places that make sense and some places it doesn't. Maybe where their houses or their operations are, some way is not necessarily the best thing to do, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Is the DEP addressing this in any way? I got the impression from the press that DEP was addressing alternative energy.
We did hand me the draft action plan for regulatory reform, and that
they want to create limited project status,
yeah.
Or they've suggested creating limited project status for things like this, which still wouldn't, you know, eliminate the need for notice of intent or whatever. It's just.
I'm not convinced that expeditious review or that, you know, limited process is going to get them out of doing notice of intent or the well is when they're actually going for the scheme.
No, it wouldn't at all.
So I think that basically they're going to be back in the same spot as what they can deal with the regulatory changes at DB.
Yeah, and I'm not, you know, you use the word expeditious. You get the feeling that when a lot of people talk about regulations in general, that is just slowing everything down. Now, I don't believe that we're slowing anything down. Almost every project comes in, and with our, you know, the way we've been going lately, we've had the right information in. We've closed the hearing the same night that it's open and issued an order of conditions. You know, there have been some, you know, where there was just a lot more information that was needed, and so we had to continue it. So I'm not sure why that, you know, that.
I
think that's just miscommunicating. You know, people are so used to thinking that, because it used to be like,
well, and
yeah,
I think
why
that
can't
they
I
thought,
do with my land what I want to do?
Well,
yeah,
that's a whole other issue.
I think
but as far as time limits, I'm talking about.
I don't think they were as concerned with the time as much as they were concerned with just their ability to actually do it at all. Because they really are looking at a giant wetland and putting their solar array right in the middle of it.
Yeah.
And there's no relief for that. I mean, they don't have the property within their property boundaries to do the necessary mitigation. So I think they were, you know, not understanding the Wetlands Protection Act well enough to get that there's kind of no way around.
So getting back to the solar farm idea, is there a piece of upland somewhere where you could do this?
Oh, there's some. Oh, sure.
And then these people could share in that in some way, and we wouldn't have, you know, 25 permit applications for 25 bad solar projects in the wetlands.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
the
there's a, right there in the Mullican Way, there's a big green area that they could, if they wanted to,
yeah,
put a good size.
It belongs to somebody else.
Right.
And I think part of their thing is they want to be the they want to do the groundbreaking part themselves. That they're the clean tech center. They've got to win these other businesses over to bring them on board with this kind of
this
thing.
This Bob O'Brien's business? Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I mean, it's a consulting business.
Yeah.
You know,
they want to have it right there next to their office. They want to be able to show it off,
but,
I think, in a way.
Yeah, but maybe a more global project would work for him, too. I mean,
definitely.
And it would take a lot of pressure off, and they wouldn't be fighting this sort of rear guard action against
mm-hmm.
all these industrial park people and the rest of the city said, well, why are you people dragging your feet? You know, we need to keep these people in the industrial park.
Mm-hmm.
Well, why don't we get open the public hearing and get these...
Are they all outside there waiting?
Yeah.
Okay, it's hiding over.
Can I get a...
Maybe they brought fewer of them.
Can I get a motion?
Motion to recess for public hearing.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay. Next item on the agenda is Commonwealth of Massachusetts and the Whittier Bridge Project.
Good evening. I'm Mike Berlin with Parsons Winkerhoff, representing MassDOT and Whittier Bridge. We just want to update you in terms of where we are. We had a very good peer review session last week. John Eric White came down. We actually we brought Julia in for a portion of the phone call. We spent almost 7 hours from about 9 o'clock and finally let people leave at 3 going through the issues. We feel like we made a lot of progress, the peer review team. And next time looking back and we'll speak for themselves, so we owe them a little bit of backup on some of the issues. But a lot of the issues they understood with a little more detail, opposition, where they were at concurrence with us. Some of them they had some questions and we're getting back with some detail. In a few places we may make some minor modifications based on some of their comments. But it was very beneficial, I think. When we come back next time, we'll have a good report with them in the audience. They should have been able to report back to the board by then. We can hopefully just do a walk through outstanding issues or questions that the board has. One of the questions, Julia, was that the wetland restriction order, you contacted CZM. Any word back?
Didn't hear back from CZM. Tried to get in touch with some folks at DEP today to see if they would be able to provide anything for us, and didn't have any luck there either. Did extensive searching online with no results, and apparently there was a map at one point in our office that had that possibly was this wetland restriction map.
It was.
Yeah, I think it got recorded at the Registry of Deeds, so...
Yeah, it's actually...
I mean, it's a public record, I think.
It should be, if that property has the restricted wetlands, it should be on the deed, assuming there's...
You know who'd have it? I've got Bill Harris.
Yeah, he does have it.
Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah.
So
when,
no, Bill?
I know, yeah, I do know that.
Yeah, because when the organization project out of Java, they brought in all these maps
that
had the restrictions.
Yeah, that map was posted... Mary's
if anybody has it, Bill's guide did
okay.
See. But
I think we're thinking very much this is just kind of a dot on the I and cross the T issue. We don't believe there are any issues up there. We think it's all it's all further downstream. And so I'm not sure where this is the right of way for the highway. We just don't.
Mm-hmm.
We tend to question at the time whether anything was put together or not. But of course, we need to close up that issue. There was a question about the existing outfalls and internal repairs. We've taken a look at it and poked around. At the base of it right now, there's a lot of exposed boulders. All the fines locally are missing, but it appears at the splash pad area to be stable. What's not stable is the slope and the pipe itself. So District 4 for MassDOT is being contacted about what internal repairs they can make in the outfall to secure that existing pipe. Through the construction phase, when we relocated about a year or so in construction. So that's what we're looking at right now in terms of that outfall. I think next time, I know there's been some questions about some construction details and barge locations or whatnot. I'd like to next time come back with some simple graphic, just looking to lay a few things out, just kind of walk through the process for you, if you can explain a little bit more detail than what I've done in the past. But I'd like to do that next time come back, and you know, talk about the process and basically the standard practices and procedures to be, that would be utilized to, you know, to collect and protect the river from some of the demolition activities and also some of the work that we do near term. We do the east side widening first. And that would be coordinated with through John Eric and the Water Commission in terms of the use of the water department land. We had a good discussion on the basin that was going to be there with Water Arc was there. We worked out, I think, some good language associated with how to deal with the basin, you know, responsibilities, you know, cleanup response if there was a major event. And we wouldn't expect any, but, you know, you can never, you know, things do happen. The type of event with the tractor trailer that overturned 3 years ago was actually caused by a northbound vehicle out of control, which crossed the median on that curve section. Well, that section will actually have a barrier, so that crossover won't happen. And also, the highway geometry in general will be a lot safer. It will be full lanes. There will be shoulders. Right now, you've got the curve, you've got the grade coming down, you've got the loss of the shoulders, loss of the lane, all of a sudden on the bridge. It's especially people who aren't familiar, and there are a lot of people who aren't familiar who pass this way occasionally because it's a vacation route. You can get surprised by the transition change in the highway. So that will be... there'll be much better geometry, much more forgiving geometry when the new structure is there. But at the same time, we need to deal with eventuality if something could happen. So we put some good processes in place. One of the things that Jenner quite requested was that we go in there with some hoods on the basins. So all the basins will have a this PVC hood, potentially, you know, for oils and floatables in the basins. The state has, I'll pass that around. It's got a couple more. The state's agreed to put on all the basins, which actually are tied into the detention basin, infiltration basin within the Newburyport Water Department land. All the catch basins will have that device on them. It's a fairly new device, but Mass DOT operations and maintenance have looked at this and they feel very comfortable with that, as opposed to the cast iron ones, which are problematic, tend to hang up the clam shells, and they typically break off and fall down the bottom of something. They don't know it. But this they feel much better about. It's got a bright color, and it's a little forgiving if it gets hit. And they feel that those will actually last pretty well. If there's any questions on anything, I'm going to run through quickly. Feel free to ask. But I was going to defer to Sarah Allen, our wetlands biologist, to talk about the salt marsh and the riverfront. They actually have some follow-up planning session again today with the state on that.
But before you leave the podium,
yes.
One of the things I learned from the revised shading study was that the design has changed a little bit. Increased widening on the southbound
yes.
side, loss of a little bit of gap between the roads. Any other design changes in the offing that are...
No, and that design change was tied to basically the addition of the shaded use path, which made the structure a little bit wider. There was a give and take going back and forth as that issue was on again, off again issue as the state was studying it. As shown,
but the shared use path is northbound, right?
Yes.
I thought I read that it's going to be a somewhat wider southbound lane. Did I?
For uniformity's sake, at one point in time, the inside shoulders, they were looking at going to 10-foot lane, to 10-foot high-speed lane in terms of adjacent to the high-speed lane. That is the newer standard, but in terms of looking at this corridor and the type of traffic that's there, there are no plans to upgrade 95 from Danvers up to the Hampshire line to include that that change. So the idea is to deal with continuity of the roadway for that 25-mile section was to keep it with a 4-foot high-speed shoulder and the 10-foot breakdown lane. In addition, quite often on an expensive structure like a long bridge, a bridge over 1,000-foot long, they don't typically have the high-speed shoulder continue at the full width. They can break it down a little bit. It's a cost issue. And typically, when you're on a long tangent or a straight section of road, it's much more safer than when you have curves and transition pieces. So So you're right. South Pond did get a little narrower as we adjusted the northbound in the structure width at that time. Okay, I wanted to defer to Sarah so she can talk about the riverfront and salt marsh.
Hello. We have been going over comments and we just were trying to adapt to what people are requesting of us. And following up on that, we met today again to try and finalize both the salt marsh planting plan and the riverfront planting area, both of which we'll provide to you in a more formal form 2 weeks from now. But in general, what we're proposing doing for the salt marsh planting is placing, we've dropped the idea of putting in a boulder sill, which is what is shown in the current plan, primarily because we're concerned that especially on an ebb flow, there would be scour created around some of the boulders, which could actually remove sediment in certain places, and we just didn't want to go there. So what we're opting for instead is, at the moment, we're looking at laying down mats, a coir mat, a coconut fiber mat, that would be embedded with salt marsh plugs. In this case, it would be Spartina altum flora because it's all low marsh down there. We're looking at putting a few inches of some kind of sand, probably a coarse medium mixed sand in there below the coir to provide a rooting substrate and securing that with landscaping staples. And filling in the gap area that's been created by the stormwater outfall. So between the two existing salt marsh patches, we would essentially provide this planting zone. That's what we're looking at. We will develop it further, obviously, and bring some plants and spend.
Is that in an area, Sarah, where the shading is such that plant could survive the Spartina?
It's definitely, it's underneath the northbound ridge. So it will be subject to some of the more, we're calling it moderate shade under there. But again, on Amesbury, Spartina altum flora is doing fine under the fall.
So it's a suitable plant for whatever the shading projections are for that particular location.
You know, in all honesty, it's not ideal. Spartina altum flora grows in open marsh. But it does seem to tolerate certain levels of shade as well. And my sense is that it will take care as well. We will have the opportunity to observe it for a couple of years, too, and we will include that. There will be, when the landscapers are installing it, they will have at least a minimum of a one-year warranty on the plants. So if there's any loss, they have to replace those. And the environmental monitor will be on the site probably another year after that, just through the construction phase of the project. And we'll keep an eye on it as well. So that's with salt marsh. With the riverfront, what we're doing is taking the results of the shading study and laying it over the riverfront planting area and identifying zones that have kind of mix of conditions. In some areas you have shade, you have adequate moisture. In other areas you have shade with more droughty conditions as you get kind of further up under the bridge. So we're developing planting plans for each of those various zones that will include plants that can tolerate those site conditions. So our approach is to work with the DOT landscape team, who has the most experience I know for planting near roadways and under bridges, to develop both the plant list and the soil specs, kind of all the specs you need for designating that kind of project. And when we come again, we will bring a graphic that we can kind of walk you through what we're proposing in terms of both planting zones and how we'll kind of drive sections.
A question about the drought issue. If water is a problem, on both sides of the bridge, both riverbanks, because the bridge, I guess, is a roof, right?
Right, correct.
And there's lots of water that basically is directed down into the river from the bridge deck. There's lots of water on both sides of the bridge that are directed into stormwater management systems. Why can't some of this water be used to, like, irrigate the area under the bridge, which is a desert?
Well, I think I'm going to let the engineers talk.
I mean, is that an impossible engineering?
It
doesn't
that.
Sound like a complicated engineering issue to me.
Well, I think there may be a way to capture some of that water and. It's a little complicated, you know, potentially put it into an underdrain type system, which could distribute it out there almost like a septic field to a certain degree, and pipe it and distribute it per pipe, with the idea that it was probably split, and, you know, and during stream flows, of course, it's going to have to divert to the outfall. It's one of those things you've got to be careful to how much water you put in there if you don't want to blow the system up either.
Right.
You don't want to build a Swiss watch, which requires, you know, valving and all the kind of things to make it work, because honestly, it won't be maintained like that, and you just can't operate like that.
I mean, if stuff won't grow there because there's not enough light, that's one thing. But if stuff won't grow there because there's not enough water, that couldn't be a problem. There's lots of water that's being directed somewhere else.
And to a certain degree, I haven't said it in all meetings, but you know. Towards the edges where there's more light, and also with more water, there'll be higher survivabilities. Under the real middles where the water's low and the sun is the lowest, I think I know they're working on some, you know, unique plans to deal with that. So I think we need to look at a little bit in terms of how we can get some of that water which comes in naturally to and basically, quote, recharge or infiltrate, but do it in a way that... doesn't require any, quote, operation to make that work. And so I guess it's almost like quite often you saw landscaping areas and there's an irrigation system with the idea that, you know, that come the third or the fourth year, it just won't operate anymore. But it's been there long enough to at least get the early growth and establishment underway.
So maybe it's an operational expense issue, really, from the
It's something that, you know, maybe can be looked at within the construction period to make sure that, you know, we have an interim side system to deal with that. That's a detail we need to look at to see how practical it is. But at the same time, we can't build a Swiss watch which is just not going to operate. We need to make sure that whatever we do, we don't create something which could take too much water, oversaturate the ground, to kind of unearth and blow everything out under pressure also.
We all have a drought-tolerant species. We have things in the air with space, little moisture. pH is also a concern. So we're going to devise our plan around those three factors. And since we, I think, we'll have four planting zones.
And just to add to that, I think we've talked about that in terms of trying to kind of get at that water, and there are some solutions to it. Our thought was to look at those solutions, and if they're available and functional, great, but to sort of plan for the worst case in the event that those systems don't work as we had hoped or whatever. And immediately under each barrel of the bridge, we were going to consider it to be the driest zone. There will be water that sort of blows in the rain. There will be water that, you know, gets there through a couple of routes, but to not rely on a steady supply of water for it. So, you know, I think we'll. I'm more comfortable with that idea. You know, if the engineers can solve it, great. That would be terrific. But in the planning stage, I think it would be smart for all of us to sort of plan for worst case and bring. What we're looking at is having if you can picture a zone immediately under the bridge of, consider it the highest degree of shade and the least amount of water, and then sort of spanning that zone working out towards the edges of the bridge, there'll be more water, more sunlight. And then outside the bridge entirely, there'll be the maximum amount of sunlight and obviously full water. And then we actually have another sort of zone, for lack of a better word, in the gap area between the two spans that will be that will receive water but won't receive quite as much sun as the outer ones will. So that's sort of how we're envisioning breaking up the bridge into these zones of varying mixes of sunlight and water. And, you know, we know a lot about plant tolerances, so depending on the site that we're dealing with, we'll try to pick the planting list that will work. We'll put in a mix of species because some will be better than others. The ones that do well will hopefully spread, and those will actually mix into the center part of the book too. So. And Jim mentioned pH. pH is another issue that roadside construction sites, pH tends to be higher. So some of the more typical New England shade tolerant species prefer acid soils, and we don't have those here. We'll have higher pH soils, so that's kind of constraining our list a little bit too. So we'll go through this whole thing in a couple of weeks' time. We'll go back more detailed plans. That's the concept, and you know, if you all have suggestions or you've seen things that work, that would be great to hear about.
We have to take any questions. Otherwise, yes, we're requesting a continuance to your February 17th. And that's when we hope to come back with a peer review team and just take any revisions and run through everything.
Can I just ask, the planting plans, will you have them available before the meeting to get to the commissioners a week in advance, or are you planning on bringing them or having them available at the meeting?
We'll certainly provide them in advance of the meeting.
Okay.
We should be able to meet that 1 week before.
Okay.
Yeah, because it'll be 3 weeks for the next meeting.
Yeah. If I could just add one other thing to that, my understanding from your time frame is that you're hoping for a close out of this year and the next CONCO meetings.
That's the goal. Right?
That's a strong desire. Okay. Anyway, by the way, I don't like coming here. It's just in the effort to get there, for the commission's benefit, for Julia's benefit, and she's sort of major, honestly. If we have enough more time, we have to review those revised plans, the comments, and so forth. The easier will be for us to give recommendations to the commission, and even draft any conditions we think are appropriate for the commission to review based on those plans, including the landscape plan, which for us we haven't seen yet. So the more time we have, the better. We try to get rid of it.
But one of the things we'd ask the peer review team to do is pull the comments together, and then we'll most likely meet. We've already touched base a couple of times with some information exchange. I think we're struggling in terms of whether we meet late this week or early next week to hopefully wrap up our issues with them. The idea they finish up an interim report, basically, which will kind of follow that matrix that was put together with all the comments, so they can come back hopefully saying that they're satisfied. We have resolved issues based on more understanding of the details or some slight changes that we've made, or for some provisional agreement that would be a good condition to place. I think at the same time, because the peer review team is involved in all three towns, I believe that we've asked them to, looking at the three towns, maybe craft some general conditions which make sense for all three, and then there may be some additional specifics per town that would be helpful. And so the more repetition of the conditions amongst the towns that we actually put in the contract, it's much easier monitoring and performance on a project basis with the contractor. This project will have an environmental monitor, on project also. So the more unified that is, they can be doing their thing. They can also set up relationships with the CONCOM agents in various towns and points of contact and discussion. So
we are in contact with other communities that talk about some of the conditions to see if we can have some similarity in the way we've been dealt with. That'd be great.
Did you say that you were having the peer reviewers put together some draft conditions?
I think we'd ask them to take a look at putting together some drafts and conditions.
We talked about that just so there's consistency.
Yeah. So I know on the wetlands end of it, he already did sort of make a lot of suggestions about special conditions, but it would be nice to have some that you thought would be applicable to all communities as well. But also on the contractor's work plan, which you mentioned you might discuss a little bit next time, mm-hmm. So in a little bit more detail, give us an idea of what kinds of things would be involved in that. And I'm trying to find where I read it, whether it was in the notice of intent or supplement or somewhere else, but there's mention of possible methods for accessing some of the piers during some, I can't remember which.
Postcard permit.
Okay.
I think the postcard permit talks about the ability to, from a float system, to get from the shore up to Pier 1 from Newburyport, or from the shore to get to Pier 3,
okay.
So they're not always depending on workboats going back and forth for the workers.
Okay, I read the term access embankment. It was a potential method.
Yeah, basically, from the top of the embankment to a float, from a float to the pier,
okay.
A series of like gangways.
Okay, that's the kind of thing that I think would be really helpful to have some of that detail at the next meeting. Because when I read the term access embankment, I thought of an embankment. You were constructing an embankment on the river, into the river.
No,
it raised all kinds of questions.
Basically, accessing from above high water.
Okay, that's so, but we just don't want to have to get the contractor's work plan later and feel like we're starting all over again with a brand new notice of intent. So any detail you could give us on things like that we can feel comfortable that we have all the conditions that we need in the permit the first go around.
Yeah, but I believe that's in the postcard permit.
Okay.
I highlighted that. I'll bring up a blow-up of that and talk to that when I talk about the other construction details.
And any other access roads for that matter to the work area?
Virtually all the accessways is going to be from the right-of-way in terms of the state property. There'll be access, of course, from Ferry Road into the Newburyport Water Property Land to build a basin. And that access will basically be down one of the fire bases and fire roads that are there to get to the location. We're working on as requested, and actually as we need to do a couple of test pits and a couple of the basin locations. I've got a draft of a plan. I'll have it finalized tomorrow. Then we're going to talk to the bore, the company that did the boring to test this for us, which is Hampshire Borings, to get them in. And then we'll talk with the town about getting a right of entry on the water department land. But they'll be coming in to do some test pits like they've done before. And we'll be doing one at Newburyport Park and Ride. And because there's some of the borings out there, so we feel very comfortable with the soil out there, but we're going to go right to the proposed basin location to do a test fit. And then on the other one, on the Newburyport Water Department land, we're going to do a couple of test fits there. And also, as requested by John Eric Boyd, we're going to put in a groundwater monitoring well that will set up established baseline conditions. And then that well, at the end of the project, will be turned over to the town for their continued use and monitoring. We set up with a lock on top of it. Forward access controls to the normal groundwater level, and they would have control out of that with monitoring as they see fit. And also, the state has submitted to the typical O&Ms for dealing with the basins that the state normally does to tie that down. So I think everything is, I think there's been good communication, there's been some good understanding. I think we're moving forward pretty well. I think if we come back and meet all our promises that we say to ourselves that we're going to do at the next meeting, hopefully that should be the closeout session, and we can move on.
So a quick question on the construction staging. The shared use path, will that be available before the southbound construction gets done?
No.
That's
one of the unique things about the project, which actually makes it less of an impact than how typically at a job like this you'd... You build a few lanes, you take part of the bridge down, and then what was proposed is that the bridge is basically it's a twin through arch with northbound, southbound, and there's three spines of the arch. So technically, you could build three lanes of traffic, move the northbound traffic over, take down the northbound traffic portion of the bridge, build three more lanes of traffic, move southbound over, demolish that piece. Then build the rest of the lane width that you needed to get the four lanes in each direction and the breakdown lanes. That's how it was proposed. One of the things as we looked at the project meeting the needs and also to have the least amount of impact to the area, basically speed up construction, instead of basically having three construction phases and two demolition phases, which turned this into probably a six-year project, we have one build phase, a demo phase, and the final build phase, and then within the existing bridge corridor, a realignment. But basically, there's two construction phases and one demolition phase, and you're not spending a lot of money to strengthen a bridge you're going to take down so it can withstand the loads of a partial demolition and still be under traffic. Mm-hmm. It was seen as a much better use of state funds to do this, and also by doing it, the first phase bridge was wider, and by making it wider, the ability to repurpose some of that extra width at the end for the shared use path became part of the project as it was renewed. So the northbound bridge is wider than the southbound bridge because initially that northbound bridge has six lanes of traffic on it. And its final configuration is four lanes of traffic, a high-speed shoulder, a breakdown lane, but there's enough lane width left over for the shared use path.
But that gets used on an annual basis
for traffic. You don't get the shared use path until the southbound bridge has been built, the southbound traffic has moved over, and then those three lanes that are on the northbound get reconfigured and slide over a little bit.
I assume that was the case.
To make room for the shared use path. So that's the last, the parting gift is when the project is done, the shared use path comes online. And that's basically summer of 2016.
Well, hopefully it will be a better parting gift than the Rose Kennedy Greenway was for the city of Boston, but
if you were down there last summer, I think you would have. That has really come alive in the past couple of years.
Well, it took a while.
There's a lot going on. A lot of people go there during the summer now.
It's still better than looking at an overpass. It still beats looking at an overpass.
Right. I'll make a motion to continue to February 7th.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay,
thank you.
Okay. Close the hearing.
Motion to close the public hearing.
Second. All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
All right, Paul, you can take over for now. Or Mary, you can take over. You take over for now.
What's up?
Enforcements and violations. I am recusing myself.
We got a three.
Andy addressed that before.
Okay.
Did you miss that? Oh, that's right. You were
I wasn't paying
attention.
I'm sorry,
you
just asked
me
a question. Budget enforcement.
Yeah, I'm just going. I'm going for the next thing on the agenda for.
Yeah, we'll follow them again tomorrow morning. But hopefully, we'll check the order that's in place. Actively, if not, we'll let them know that and follow the enforcement order with further instructions to clarify that. And I don't know how you want to handle it, but I assume he wants to convey that to us in the next meeting, since for some reason they couldn't be here tonight. To address full head. You did mention previously the reference to your enforcement order, the color discharge. It's a continual concern of the commission, despite what DEP has said, which is that it's a non-issue.
They can come in with a plan for rectifying this whole issue?
Yeah, I mean, we talked to them about it. When I talked to them, it was basically explain what had been done thus far and providing a plan for the rest of the temporary season, until the springtime, essentially, stabilize the area. And the spring permanent fix, grass taking and so forth.
So where does the enforcement order work in here, time-wise? That was the question you were just asking of us.
Well, I was hearing that, which is one of the instructions given them, and they show up tonight to address the concern. It's a few, I know we have all that sort of stuff. Erosion control, they say they've dealt with it. I haven't been able to verify that since we saw progress work last week. So, I'd have to follow up on that to know whether they've actually complied with that aspect of the order.
So. Given the fact that the Leader Bridge is going to take a lot of time, I would think next time, particularly if they want to try to get through it, maybe they could get their proposal in advance of the meeting.
Okay, as they're recommending, sure.
Just to give us a chance. Otherwise,
yeah.
That's a problem.
I'm concerned about that.
Yeah.
of that meeting.
Because they're both serious issues.
Yeah, we'll tell them to email that to us, that way we can write it out to you, tell them to ask for a review, maybe even help give us feedback if we're not able to get this information. Hopefully it's been stabilized at least for now.
Take pictures.
We have been, yeah. We took some out there, we'll take some. We took some out there, really. Take those out there, we'll take some. We'll be trying again to see if we can.
Nothing's frozen. I mean, it's like springtime. It's so bizarre. I have like at work full on wetlands projects going, full on, like as if it's the middle of the summer.
Yeah.
Permit assessments, you know.
Motion to adjourn.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed?
I mean, between the mild weather and the glut of natural gas, I mean, you know, you gridsters must be really suffering.
I'm not a gridster.
Oh, that's right. I keep